right, all right. Welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm joined in the studio today with what appears to be my new companion, Love Nut. Okay? I don't know. It came from pistachio growers, American pistachio growers. It's the Love Nut, and it's sitting here ready to chide me at any mistake I make, all right? But we have a great show for you today. And that's what I want to get into. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Raymond Latta. Raymond's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and he's also involved with the Setting the Record Straight project around the truth about revolution and communism, socialist society. He's also an advocate of Bob Avakian's New Synthesis. And Raymond will be talking with us about recent developments in the National Defense Authorization Act, and we'll get into that when we introduce that part of the show. But I'm really looking forward to it. There's a very heavy developments there, as people have been following the hearings and the rest of this stuff. There's a lot to talk about, a lot that's up for, you know, basically people got to look at it very seriously with open eyes and understand what the hell is going on here. But opening the show up, I'm really, really pleased to be bringing you the final segment, the conclusion of the five-part interview that I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. And if people remember the last segment of the interview, I know a lot of people were like calling me, what did you do? Why did you leave off with that? I left off with posing a question to Bob Avakian and about, do people have to be angels in order for this revolution to be, this revolution, this socialist society, this communist world to be realized? And he looked at, and he basically stopped and he said, no. And I stopped it there. And people were saying, well, I wanted to know what happened? Why not? Well, the reason is you're going to find out today, all right? And in this part of the interview, we come into this part off of the question that was posed last week, and that question being, do people have to be angels in order for such a revolution and socialist society to be realized? And Avakian answered it with a resounding no, and digging into this, he paints a picture of what his new synthesis of communism would look like in socialist society, the importance of things like a constitution, and then he talks about what it is that has kept him and continues to keep him on the revolutionary road after all these decades, all right? So without any further ado, this is Bob Avakian being interviewed by me, Michael Slate. So let's listen.
Now, I know what you sort of were, you know, implying here or you know, were suggesting is that many people say, well, what you're talking about sounds good, but it only work if people were angels, quote unquote. This is the old thing, if, you know, if it used to be said in the old days, if men were angels. You know, if people were angels, then okay, we wouldn't need, you know, the kind of society we have. But once again, we're back to, since people are not angels, they're basically selfish and out for self above all, etc., then we can't have the kind of society you're talking about. We have to have a society that corresponds to that. And lo and behold, guess what? It's the society we have now. So, you know, but then let's go directly to this question. Do people have to be, quote-unquote, perfect or angels in order for this revolution and its goal of first socialism and ultimately a communist world to actually be realized? No. In fact, that's one of the reasons why you need a constitution, because you are going to have the contradictions left over from the old society when you make a revolution, including the contradictions in the thinking of people, in the culture, in the ways that they're influenced, and so on, which you're going to have to struggle through at the same time and in connection with struggling through to transform further the economy, the social relations, the political structures, institutions, and processes, and so on. So that's why we've already, you know, even before the revolution has been made, we've brought forward a constitution for the new socialist republic in North America draft proposal in order to both lay out the vision and as concretely as we can of the actual ways in which that society would function and what would be its principles and, you know, and guidelines for how it should function in basic terms, while recognizing that there would be many particulars that we cannot anticipate now, and these principles would have to be applied in a creative way to those circumstances and might have to be adjusted in this or that particular, but while the core would be adhered to and carried forward. And we do go into this. This document is both very sweeping and also very concrete in a lot of ways, dealing with how the political system would function, how the economy would function, dealing with the realms of healthcare, education, science, the media, the armed forces, and so on and so forth. And I really strongly urge people to read and to seriously get into this Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America draft proposal and set it down next to and compare and contrast it with the present constitution we have of an exploitive and oppressive system which began on a foundation of slavery, among other things, and also to look into the constitutions of previous socialist countries to see how this one is different. This Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America draft proposal is different in some ways from those previous socialist constitutions. If you want to actually see in important ways what this new synthesis of communism is all about, this constitution is an important way to begin digging into that, both in terms of the different particular aspects of social life and transformation, but also in terms of philosophy and method, and also in terms of the fundamental internationalism that informs this constitution and the new synthesis that it's an expression of, and the whole basic orientation that the goal is the emancipation of humanity as a whole. So once again, I really urge people to really dig into this. I would like to see this a course taught comparing and contrasting these different constitutions in colleges, but also in high schools. And I think it's something that students could actually, contrary to the way in which they're slandered and the way in which sometimes it appears they're not interested in big things, I think they could really get into this in a big way. So I just put that plug in for
that. That's great. Actually, that would be tremendous.
I think that could actually be very, you know, to be serious, I think it could be a really good thing.
Yeah.
And help develop people's sense of a possibility, you know, break the sense of the permanent necessity of existing conditions, and also give people a concrete sense of a radical alternative as well as a sweeping sense of that, and also develop their ability to think critically in comparing and contrasting these things. So why do you have a constitution? You have a constitution in effect, and to put it very simply, sets down the basic rules and principles on which society should function and will function. And precisely the purpose of a constitution like this is to address the fact that you're not dealing with perfect human beings, and you're not dealing with angels. You're not dealing with people as they would be in the future after society and the people who make up society have gone through further transformation in the socialist period and carrying forward the revolution further in that new situation. You're dealing with people who have undergone many important changes in coming to the recognition and the consciousness that they need a revolution and that they need to fight together with other people for that revolution. But you're also dealing with people who are still significantly, to use a somewhat crude phrase, stamped with the influence of the society out of which they've come and you know, through which they've emerged to this new society. So a constitution sets down rules and principles in which people can relate in a different way, in which the economy and the social relations and the political system can be developed in a radically different way, but also in which the rights of the people are delineated and clear and set down, and the principles guiding those rights are made clear, and a standard is provided to which people should adhere, and to which people, in a real sense, will be held in terms of what their relations with other people can and cannot be. That you can't, you know, for example, you'll have laws that are passed based on this Constitution by the legislative bodies that the Constitution provides for to be set up through the functioning of this society in accordance with this Constitution. You have laws which will protect people's rights, but will also prevent people from doing certain things. You can't go into your neighbor's house and you know, shoot your neighbor and take their property. You can't go out and assault women. You can't rape women. You can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation or on the basis of nationalities. So it'll both set forward standards for people to aspire to, but it will also indicate the standards of what the society insists are ways in which people should relate to each other, but also ways in which they can't relate to each other, in ways that are oppressive and exploitative, while at the same time, and this is an important part of the new synthesis of communism, allowing for, and not only allowing for, but fostering and creating an atmosphere in which dissent will play an important part in society, and an atmosphere in which there will be encouraging of dissent, in which dissent, including from the policies of the party and the policies of the government, which dissent, even of that kind, can actually be encouraged and flourish. So all that is also part of what's stressed in this Constitution, both in talking about the rights of the people, but also in terms of talking about the educational system in this socialist society, and the priority it puts on promoting what it calls a spirit of scientific curiosity and critical thinking, and a whole way in which it addresses the question of art and culture, including the support to some art and culture which is directly oppositional to what is the prevailing policy at a given time of the government, and what is, you know, what the party might be arguing and struggling for within the society at a given time. And art and also provides for people to develop art and culture, you know, would be the equivalent of garage bands and things like that, people doing on their own initiative, even without government funding, and the ability of them to go out and raise funds for that art and culture, so long as they don't use it for the actual production and promotion of that art and culture, and not to set up businesses on the side to exploit other people. So one of the purposes of having a constitution is you recognize that you have people as they've come out of the old society, even though they've gone through big changes to get to the point where they are seeing the need for and willing to fight and sacrifice and to unite with other people and overcome the kind of petty rivalries that are so much of daily life in this society in order to unite with people to make a revolution. You're still dealing with people that have come out of the old society. And let's face it, when everybody gets to the high point of struggling for something, a lot of petty differences get put to the side and overcome. But then when the struggle subsides, a lot of them reassert themselves. And this will happen even after you've had a whole big revolutionary change. So you have a constitution and you have guidelines and principles, both in that constitution and in terms of the approach of the party, which is still has the responsibility of leading all this, to recognize that and to carry forward the struggle to further transform the culture and people's ways of thinking, together with transforming the economy, the social relations, the political system, the political structures and institutions, and so on, and the relations internationally, all aiming toward a radically different world where you won't have angels, but you'll have the absence of oppressive and antagonistic relations among people, and people in different parts of the world will not be at loggerheads with each other, divided up into separate nations and countries. And differences will still exist and still be struggled out, and maybe there'll even be a few, you know, people who have mental illnesses, other things, who will do things that are detrimental to society. But you won't need a state, a dictatorship, to actually enforce the interests of the prevailing system. These things can be handled through the mutual interaction of people on an increasingly conscious and voluntary basis. And even problems like people who have mental problems will be dealt with in a radically different way without having to have a whole system of police and jails and so on to deal with it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is part five of the five-part interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. In this segment, Avakian talks about why people don't have to be perfect in order for revolution, socialism, and communism to work, okay? If you missed any part of this interview, any one of the segments that we ran earlier, you can access them by going to revcom.us. That's revcom.us. Which brings me to this point, dictatorship. Because even as you say all this, this does involve the dictatorship of the proletariat. That's an important part of the new synthesis, right?
Yes, and this is also embodied in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic. There are ways in which that Constitution and the new synthesis in general envisions this dictatorship being exercised differently than in some ways than in the past socialist societies and their experience. But, you know, look, a dictatorship doesn't mean you have a few people ordering everybody around. That's why one of the reasons why we have a constitution. People's, you know, the procedures and the processes and institutions of the governance of society are spelled out there, including the way in which elections will play a role in that through various forms. And the whole point is that you need a government and a state, including, yes, security forces and armed forces, both to protect your revolution, but also, you know, from foreign enemies and from internal forces will actually try to violently overthrow it and sabotage it violently and so on. But also, you need a state to back people up who've been the formerly oppressed and exploited people, but who are now coming to the forefront, whether it's people who've been discriminated against in the old society in various ways, or, you know, people have been bitterly exploited under the old system, or women whose oppression has been one of the foundation stones of the whole system and has been bound up with the division of society into exploiters and exploited since that first emerged in human history thousands of years ago. These forces need backing from the state in order to be able to, in a certain sense, go uphill to fight to continue to transform and eliminate the remaining elements of the old oppressive relations and traditions and the ways of thinking that go along with it. So when we talk about a dictatorship, we're talking about a state which serves those classes and groups in society who are striving to further transform society toward the abolition of all these old traditions and relations that oppress and exploit people. And we're talking about a state which protects the rights of people, such as what I was referring to earlier, that, you know, you work, you know, the idea of socialism and communism is not, by the way, that everybody will have the same toothbrush or, you know, be like birds, you know, everybody will eat the same food. Some people will eat it and regurgitate it, and then other people eat it. That's not the whole point.
I'm going to make sure I'm in the right place in line, okay?
That is not what is meant by communism. Communism and socialism, moving toward communism, means the common ownership through the state, but increasingly by all of society, of the means of production and resources of creating wealth in society, the land, the factories, the machinery, the technology, and so on. And the marshaling and utilization of that according to a plan drawn up by drawing on the thinking of the people and then systematizing and concentrating it to actually utilize and marshal the resources of society in a planned way to meet the needs of the people both materially and also intellectually and culturally, to put away store for the future and for natural disasters, to defend the revolution, and also to support the revolution in the world as a whole while the revolution is being backed and supported in its further continuation within the socialist country itself. That's the whole point of a socialist state. And that's the whole point of what we mean by the common ownership by the people of the means of production and resources of society. Not that all the consumer items and items of personal consumption that people have will be owned by everybody, and there'd be this horrible situation of everybody having to use everybody's toothbrush or something like that. But there is a fact that there will still be personal items. And there will still be, because of the influences of the old society, both ideologically and also the remaining inequalities that I've spoken about, there will still be a need to protect people's rights, including their right to their personal items of consumption, from encroachment by other people who might try to wrongfully take it away, even if that's not a major social phenomenon. So you need a state for all those reasons. And when you say a dictatorship, what you're reflecting is the fact that so long as you have society divided into different classes and social groups, then the state is going to reflect the interests of the economically dominant class, the class that dominates in terms of its ownership of the major means of production and resources of society. In capitalism, that's the capitalist class, or to use the French word, the bourgeoisie. And so you have a capitalist or a bourgeois dictatorship. In socialist society, it's the formerly exploited class of working people, the proletariat, and the broad masses of people who have now become the people who are now determining the direction of society. And they are utilizing the state to back up their struggle to carry forward that revolution and to prevent the principles and laws that are in the Constitution and flow from the Constitution from being violated in ways that would undermine the further transformation of that society and the support for the world revolution. And the goal, unlike all previous societies, is not just to get a stronger and stronger state. It's to move together with the revolutionary struggle throughout the world to where you've overcome all these different class divisions, oppressive relations and inequalities, and the ways of thinking and culture that go along with them, so that you no longer have antagonistic divisions or oppressive divisions among any part of humanity anywhere in the world. And therefore, you no longer need, and you no longer should have and will not have, a state to back up the rule of one part of society over another, even if that one part, as in socialism, represents the interests of the great majority of society and is moving in the direction of eliminating any oppressive divisions between people in society. Now, until you get to that point, you need a state to help and to back up, not only to defend the revolution, but to help and back up the struggle toward that. But you also should have, and in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America, draft proposal, says very clearly that one of the clear principles of the state and of the party which is leading the state is not only to continuously propagate the goal of moving toward all that, moving toward the elimination of all these divisions, and therefore moving beyond the need for any kind of a state or any kind of a dictatorship, but to actually carry forward transformations in society that more and more involve people in the governance of society, in determining the affairs of state, and moving in the direction where the state can eventually, as Marx put it, wither away, together with the withering away, or the overcoming, I should say, more actively overcoming, of the remaining vestiges, if you will, of the old oppressive relations and inequalities. So the point being, if you don't have a state to defend your revolution and to back up people carrying forward that revolution, and along with that, to actually protect the rights of the people in that society, then you're going to get forces who are going to move to and succeed in overthrowing your revolution. And all the struggle and sacrifice that has gone into making that revolution is not only going to be wasted, but it's going to be drowned in blood. And then it won't just be ideological revenge that'll be taken. There'll be very practical and murderous revenge taken on the people who made that revolution, particularly on the people at the very bottom of society who finally were able to break through, raise their heads, and lead others to fight all the way through. They are going to be subjected to the most merciless revenge on the part of the people who fought and were defeated initially to maintain the old society, but have now come back and are determined that never again will people even dare to think about rising up in this way.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is part five of the five-part interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. In this segment, Avakian talks about why people don't have to be perfect in order for revolution, socialism, and communism to work, okay? If you missed any part of this interview, any one of the segments that we ran earlier, you can access them by going to revcom.us. That's revcom.us.
Let me ask you this. This will be the last one on this section, and then we'll wrap the interview up. But I wanted to ask you this. How do you keep people from settling in? How do you keep people from saying, look, we got it pretty damn good now? And in a weird way, a kind of very weird reassertion of permanent necessity of existing conditions. How do you keep that from happening?
Well, I think it's a combination of different things. One, there's a need for continual... This is one of the reasons why you need continual leadership, to continually raise people and struggle to raise people's sights to the larger goal. That we can't stop the revolution halfway, because then if we do, it'll be reversed. I mean, I've used the example of rock climbing. You know, I've read about people, I've never done this, but I've read about people in Yosemite and places, who go up these steep, some of them even without safety ropes, which I think is, I want to talk about something crazy. I think that's absolutely insane, but they do it, you know. But in leaving that aside, the particularity of without safety ropes, I've read about, these rock climbing up these steep cliffs, and how, you get to a certain ledge and you can sort of, you're confronted with how do you reach, and not only reach sometimes, but actually make a leap to grab a new handhold in order to keep going up. And if you try to just stay where you are, eventually you're going to wear out and you're probably going to fall. So to use that as a metaphor, it's a somewhat tortured metaphor, but I think it has, it has some purpose here. Some usefulness here. It's kind of like making a revolution, even after you've taken the first great leap and overthrown the old system and established the new, you have to continue the revolution up this steep precipice. And you have to keep making leaps and grabbing new footholds, which is, people become reluctant to do because it means taking further risks and risking giving up what you've gained so far. But if you don't, as with the rock climbing, to once again slightly torture the metaphor, you can fall all the way back down. And furthermore, to further embellish and perhaps, further torture the metaphor, you're doing this not in perfect weather. It's often storming, because that being, equivalent to the attacks from the enemies of the revolution, both within the society, but also from countries around the world who don't want to see the example and the force of this revolution spread. So you will have a constant tendency, the point of all this, you'll have a constant tendency to settle in, and to say, we've made great changes, life is much better, so why don't we just stop here, even though there are remaining oppressive relations. One of the main ways that will take form and find expression is around the relation between men and women and the status of women. That there'll be a tendency to say, let's not go further with that because it's going to disturb a lot of things in the family and a lot of personal relations, and it's going to disturb the unity that's been forged. So let's just stop it. which if you do that, it means that women are going to still be held by the various chains of oppression that have held them down for thousands of years, and things are going to be propelled in the direction of going backward in regard to that, as well as in a more overall sense. But there's also a positive side to this picture, which is in addition to a leadership which constantly is struggling to raise people's sights to the need to continue the revolution and to support it in the world as a whole, because if you don't make this revolution in the world as a whole, and the whole world is not being transformed toward the emancipation of humanity, then you're going to be pushed back anywhere that you've initially broken through and established a socialist state. So you got to go forward toward the final goal. So you need a leadership that's constantly struggling to raise people's sights to that through the, you know, what it does in the realm of culture as well as in politics and so on. But in addition, that leadership, it's very important for that leadership to also be able to identify what are the contradictions in society that are kind of acute concentrations of the need to continue the revolution, of the need to continue transforming society. I mentioned the status of women. This will be one of the things in socialist society that will most concentrate the need to continue the revolution and will bring forward forces who need to be fostered and supported, who want to fight to make sure this revolution doesn't stop halfway and leave women still in a chained position or an inferior and subordinated position, even if it's improved over the horrors of what it was in the old society. And there will be other forces in society that will come forward around some of the remaining contradictions, which are still elements and still concentrate elements of the old existing within the new that need to be overcome and transformed. And it's the role of leadership to continue recognizing and fostering and giving support and leadership to these forces who want to fight around these contradictions that can propel the revolution forward, including in relation to the whole international dimension. But there's no magic solution to any of these things. There's no magic wand that you can wave. There's no formula you can set down on things and say, if you just apply this, everything's going to go. This is a matter of struggle. It's a living process all the way through, from now all the way to the goal of communism. And then there'll be a living process of people transforming society and communism, you know, when there are no longer antagonistic relations among people, but there's still contradictions among people and in terms of their relations with the rest of nature and in the thinking of the people and so on. It's just that it won't be embedded in a whole system and dynamics of oppression and exploitation and antagonism among people. So, you know, you need this kind of leadership to get there, but there is, you know, the leadership has to be constantly regrounding itself in and further developing and implying in a creative way the scientific outlook and method that's needed for this. And, you know, that you're going to make mistakes. You have to learn from your mistakes. You know, there's no great, if you pardon the expression, enterprise, or in better said, maybe endeavor by human beings. Certainly any kind that attempts to solve any big problems that isn't going to go off course at times and make mistakes. This is all part of the process. You have to be able to recognize where you've gone off course or made mistakes and struggle to get back on course and learn from the whole process. And it's a living process. You know, that is the point from Goethe about, you know, life is, the tree of life is green. Theory is very important, but real life will be much more, you know, rich and more complex than that. You have to keep on learning and struggling. And the way that you have the possibility, and it's just a possibility, it's not a guarantee, but it's a real possibility of actually going forward with this and learning from mistakes and setbacks and going forward again till you reach the goal of communism ultimately. The way you have that is both the orientation of continually fighting to keep that larger goal in mind and evaluating everything in terms of how it relates to that larger goal, and at the same time, the scientific outlook and method of communism, not as a dry and once and for all finished dogma, but as a living science that has to be applied, and, you know, an ongoing process of theory and practice and back to theory and learning from reality as you're changing reality.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is part 5 of the 5-part interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. In this segment, Avakian talks about why people don't have to be perfect in order for revolution, socialism, and communism to work, okay? If you missed any part of this interview, any one of the segments that we ran earlier, you can access them by going to revcom.com. revcom.us. That's revcom.us.
I have to ask you this. Is that what keeps you going? I mean, I was telling you earlier, when you talked about, and this really struck me, and I don't know why it struck me so heavily, because I've seen it before, but the points that you've made, and you were continuing to make tonight, about communism is not inevitable, that this isn't something that's just going to, it was destined to happen, but that it's the way things came together, and then there's the conscious working on this. And you, above all, I mean, I think that the point that, literally, if people haven't had a chance to see your revolution talk, or to have listened to your, you know, your conversations with people, you know, this point, you vibrate with a boundless enthusiasm for communism, for revolution, for communism, for the emancipation of humanity. You really do vibrate with that. It's almost like every fiber is sort of like on fire around, we've got to get here. And I really wanted to ask you, and I know this is sort of it's at the end of this very intense wrestling with a lot of questions, but I really wanted to ask you, and for you to give people a sense of, what is it that keeps you on that road, that keeps you from settling in?
Well, I think there are two main things. One is, at a certain point in my life, I came to see the world, you know, in basic terms, the way it is, and the terrible way in which the majority of humanity is suffering. And more than that, the fact that we arrive at the point where this is completely needless. And, you know, it's one thing for suffering to be horrific, but when it's totally unnecessary, it becomes all the more intolerable. And I've never lost my sense of that. And I continually go back to that, you know, that the revolution we're talking about and the struggle for communism is not just some sort of personal endeavor. It's not about people being able to finally reach their own personal aspirations or overcome their personal frustrations, you know, or even to just realize a personal vision. It's about the condition and the possibilities for the masses of people in the world and ultimately for humanity as a whole. And the fact that on the other side of that, if we don't make this revolution, if we don't advance to communism, if you look what people are put through, if you look what's happening with the environment, if you look at the wars and the arsenals that are waged and maintained by these imperialist powers, you can see that life is going to continue to be a horror if there even is a future after a certain point for humanity. So you constantly come back to the fact that this revolution is necessary, but also that it's possible. And that kind of interacts with the very crucial point of science, in particular the science of communism, because you can lose that sense even if you have, you know, really deeply grounded sensibilities and feelings around that, around the condition of humanity and the fact that this needs to be radically changed. You can lose your bearings and have that sense dulled if you don't continually apply the science, you know, a scientific approach and method, and in specifically the science of communism, to continue in probing and investigating, learning about and summing up what you're learning and identifying the patterns that you're seeing in reality. And in the way in which this enables you to get more and more deeply grounded in an understanding that in fact not only is the world intolerable and will remain that way for the great majority of humanity if we don't have a revolution and we don't break through and eventually get to communism in the world as a whole, but that this is actually not the only way the world could be, that there is actually a basis within the way the world has actually developed and within the contradictory character of the reality that we're up against and the pathways that opens or the possibilities of struggle that can be forced out of that to actually get to communism. And when you combine the basic orientation that I spoke of not turning away from, but constantly confronting and being grounded in a basic sense in the reality of what this world and this system means for the great majority of humanity up against the potential of a much better way the world could be. And the fact that this is not the only possible way, that there is no permanent necessity to these conditions, that we could have a radically different and much better world. That orientation, sort of interacting with and being mutually reinforced by and with the science of communism and its application in the way I've been speaking of, is what gives you the basis to keep going forward. And the more that you have that, the more that you are fired, in fact, with a drive and an enthusiasm, yes, to fight for that and to do everything you can to contribute to it.
Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and a man whose vision and work has opened up a door to a whole new world and who is leading the fight to get there. Thank you very much for doing this interview and for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
All right, that was an interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the RCP, and that was the fifth and final segment of that interview. And if you've missed any, and if you were inspired off of this, let me put it that way, if you were inspired off this, if you wanted to dig into more about what he's talking about, if you sat back and thought, wait a minute, it's true. It is possible. We don't have to live like this. It is possible to be living a whole different way. If that's the situation, make sure you get access to this interview. You go to revcom.us and access all of them right there and learn a whole lot more about the entire movement for revolution that Avakian is leading. We're going to take a short musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Raymond Latta about the new things going on around the National Defense Authorization Act. So stay tuned. All right, you can't go wrong with Creedence Clearwater Revival, and that was Bad Moon Rising. Man, I remember walking down the boardwalk in Wildwood, New Jersey on a Saturday night, singing that song with all my friends, and just it said something to us, and it says something today to us. All right, so maybe we could just play another second and let it run out and... All right, we're down to business now. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Raymond Latta. Raymond's a writer with Revolution Newspaper. He's also one of the initiators of the call that came out a little while ago. It was printed in the Nation magazine at the end of last year in opposition to the National Defense Authorization Act and everything that's been going on around that. And he is also an advocate of Bob Avakian's New Synthesis of Communism. Raymond, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Well, I want to jump into this. There's a, basically, if people have been following the news or following anything about it, there was a hearing around the NDAA, a lawsuit trying to get an injunction against the enforcement of certain sections of it. But there's also been recently Obama signed the 2013 NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, which continued the trajectory of really ratcheting up and bolting down an increasingly repressive machinery, state machinery. And it caused, if people looked at it, everything from preventing the closure of Guantanamo to actually authorizing the indefinite detention of anyone, including U.S. citizens arrested on U.S. soil. This is, again, what you and others have pointed out with the 2012 NDAA. You had pointed out that this was actually not just a continuation, but a real leap in all of these, this repressive apparatus under Obama, between Bush and Obama. Can you talk about, let people know, what is the NDAA? What is the National Defense Authorization Act? What is it, and what's it part of in terms of the overall framework?
Okay. As you mentioned, the National Defense Authorization Act, which is referred to as the NDAA, was pushed through and is the handiwork of the Obama administration. Now, in the Bush years, they had created this category of enemy combatants, and these were people that were designated as such, and they could just be summarily picked up and locked up anywhere. And this was the policy and the practice during the Bush years, creating this category and subjecting people to this, indefinite detention. But it was kind of an ad hoc thing, and this was what the Bush administration did. Now, Obama has taken this to a new level. He is actually institutionalizing. He is seeking to make indefinite detention and military trials, things that happened during the Bush years, he's seeking to make, through the medium of the National Defense Authorization Act, to make indefinite detention and military trials a permanent part of the functioning of the legal repressive apparatus in the United States. And this National Defense Authorization Act has a provision within it. In other words, it's like 500 pages, statutes and various measures concerning, defense appropriations and policy, et cetera, but Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act in 2012 authorizes the indefinite military detention of people without charge or trial, and they would be placed in military custody for the alleged crime of associating with forces or individuals who themselves had nothing to do with 9/11 or with terrorism in general. But they've created this vague category of associated forces, and they've created this vague concept of substantially supporting Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, or, as they say, associated forces. And this is just very vague, very general, very broad. What does substantial support mean? Who are these associated forces? It's like 2, 3, 4, 5 degrees of separation, and they can snatch you for this alleged crime of associating with a broad and vague category of people. And this, is a very ominous and draconian development. As I said, what it's doing is actually institutionalizing, and bringing to the level of law and legal statute, this practice, of being able to snatch people up, put them into military prison, including, shipping them off to offshore prisons. This is all within, the capability and the capacity of this law. And it says that people can be held until the end of hostilities. And there is no terminal point, that is being pointed to. This war without end that's taking place is indefinite, and indefinite detention is part of the picture.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Raymond Latta. Raymond is a writer for Revolution Newspaper. He's also an advocate of Babavakian's New Synthesis of Communism, and we're talking about the National Defense Authorization Act. You know, Raymond, there's a point, as you're talking about all this, there's a point that you made early on in the fight around this, in bringing out the, analyzing what was going on with this NDAA. You made the point that there needs to be protest, outcry, protest, and resistance to this. And unfortunately, there's very little of that to not something that's commensurate with what you're describing in terms of the danger posed by all this and the actual threat that's being, wielded under all this, the reality of that actually for people here and people all over the world. The need for protest and resistance. Let's talk about that, because there were a couple things that have come up. We can talk a little later about the call that you were part of of initiating that was published in the Nation. But let's talk about also there's been actually legal challenges to this as well, right?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just want to make clear that this law, as ominous as it is, it's clearly aimed at criminalizing dissent and oppositional, speech and opposition to the status quo. So it's very, very dangerous in this regard. Now, it's also taking place in the context of, the overall ratcheting up of repression, the continuation of rendition, the continuation extension of the Patriot Act. And then we have this, drone policy that's now coming to the into some, public discussion, but, this is an assassination policy, targeted assassination. So these things do need to be called out for what they are. They are, crimes against humanity when we're dealing with the drone program, and they need to be called out in terms of this illegitimate and dangerous expansion of governmental authority to quash, any oppositional, speech, movements of resistance for social change, under the, rubric of this, kind of, this law, the National Defense Authorization Act. Now, there have been challenges to this. The problem is right now that there is not sufficient public awareness of what's going on, this whole pattern of the Obama administration and what this represents, the dangers both for here today and in the future, what they're trying to, to seal into and lock into place these repressive measures. And, there has been a legal challenge to the National Defense Authorization Act, which was a lawsuit that was initiated by Chris Hedges, the journalist, and several other activist journalists who feared that their writings and associations might lead the government to lock them up in military detention. So they have been litigating this suit, and in May of last year, a federal judge ruled in their favor that these provisions for the indefinite military detention were unconstitutional. And that was a positive ruling. But insinuated into this ruling was a very, very bad thing that Chris Hedges has, in his testimony, Chris Hedges made these extremely erroneous and harmful characterizations of the Revolutionary Communist Party and its chairman, Bob Avakian. And he said in his testimony, the party advocates violence. And in a subsequent brief that has been filed, and that was on December 10th, he continued to make this mischaracterization of the party, and he said that it was an advocate of violence and, quote, embraces acts that could be construed as terrorist, unquote. This is outrageous, Michael. The party and Bob Avakian have consistently expressed their opposition to terrorism. This is a genuine revolutionary organization that is being characterized as something that it is not. And here we have a situation where the National Defense Authorization Act is being challenged legally, but it's being challenged in a way that's actually harmful to others and harmful to the broader struggle to beat back this repression.
All right, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Raymond Latta. Raymond's a writer for Revolution Newspaper. He's an advocate of Bob Avakian's New Synthesis, and we're talking about the National Defense Authorization Act. Now, this has been included, as I understand it, this actual mischaracterization has been included in the various rulings that have come down from the judge on this stuff, right? The injunctions and whatnot. It continues to sort of re-present itself through the course of all these, including, was it also included in what was argued yesterday?
Now, here's what's going on. This was in this terribly erroneous and very dangerous mischaracterization of the party and Bob Avakian was right in the midst of the judge's May 16th ruling. She incorporated points that were made in Hedges' testimony. It was part of the case record. It is part of the court record. And it is now still there. In the hearing that took place, this was a hearing, that was 2 days ago. That hearing is part of the continuing challenge to this law, because in September, Judge Forrest's May 16th ruling was overturned. The government got a temporary injunction, and then they got a permanent injunction. And these litigants, Chris Hedges and others, have been continuing to appeal that overruling of the judge's May 16th order. And in doing that, they filed a brief that now contained even more damaging misinformation, mischaracterization, toxic and very harmful of the party. This is unacceptable. This is really politically and morally unconscionable. And the reason this has happened is because Chris Hedges is trying to establish that he will be hurt as a journalist. He will be hurt as a journalist by this law, because if he associates with certain kinds of people, that will mean that he could be subject to the detention provisions of the NDAA. However, what he is doing is he's actually saying that his career is going to be harmed, his activity is going to be injured, because he's reluctant to interview figures from groups like the RCP, with whom he has had past association. But in doing that, what he says is causing injury to him by this law, he is creating new dangers, new impediments, and tremendous potential for injury to others. This is the situation, that I am calling out as being betrayal.
Well, Raymond, tell me this, Raymond. Tell me this, what are the real-world consequences in this? I don't mean to rush you, but I have a couple other questions. I want to get through it, and we have about maybe 7 minutes left to talk. What are the real-world consequences of this thing standing the way it is right now?
Well, first of all, this can provide a pretext. This can provide a pretext for government investigation, for harassment, and for persecution. It can provide a pretext to that. Second, it can be an incitement to reactionary forces. You know, you have people who are, you know, patrolling the border of the United States to defend the sanctity of the United States. You have these reactionary forces. You have people that want to keep America, quote, safe from terrorism. So this can be an incitement to that. And while this inclusion in the May 16th ruling and its inclusion in this new brief doesn't have any legal binding, it is in that May 16th ruling. So it carries a certain imprimatur of legal finding. And it is taking place in this atmosphere, Michael, this post-9-1 atmosphere of suspicion and, you know, the fanning of fear and this whole bogeyman of, you know, of any opposition is linked up with something that's going to threaten, you know, is a terrorist, kind of a terrorist underpinning to it. So this is very, very dangerous. And let me just say, you know, back in, you know, 1980, the Los Angeles Times distorted a statement by Bob Avakian, and that became a pretext for a Secret Service investigation. So this is very real. These consequences are very real. And it is, again, setting a very bad standard. It's not acceptable. It is not permissible to protect one's own self and organization by bringing harm and injury to others.
All right, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Raymond Latta. Raymond's a writer for Revolution Newspaper. He's an advocate of Bob Avakian's New Synthesis, and we're talking about the National Defense Authorization Act. You were one of the initiators, as I said, of a call that was signed by 750 people or more, published in The Nation, was really rallying people around opposing the NDAA and what's going on with that, but also insisting that there were certain standards that had to be met in the fight against repression. And you referenced Niemöller and the bitter lesson that was learned for the movement today from the experience in Germany.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, this is very critical. This is very critical. What the call does, this was signed by more than 700 academics, social activists, artists, lawyers, people like Daniel Ellsberg have signed it, Cornel West has signed it, Peter Coyote and Mark Ruffalo, the actors, have signed it. It's a very broad array of people. And what we're saying is that, one, we have to oppose, you know, this whole repressive juggernaut that's coming down, and in particular the National Defense Authorization Act. But second, it's affirming a core principle that we cannot allow the government to determine what groups or individuals are politically acceptable or politically unacceptable, and we can't allow and we can't permit radical, progressive, and revolutionary organizations to be divided along those lines. We have to stand together. We have to oppose this repression, and we can't allow any particular group, but in this case, the Revolutionary Communist Party and Bob Avakian, to be singled out for attack. People have different views about the party, different levels of understanding about it, but there's a core principle, and this derives from the experience of Niemöller in the 1930s in Germany. And I think it's important for listeners to know about this, that there was a lesson there that has profound application for today. And, you know, Niemöller had written this famous poem. First they came for the communists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak out because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me, and by that time, no one was left to speak out for me. And the importance of this, Michael, and, you know, the listening audience, is that Pastor Niemöller was someone who originally supported the Nazi regime and then came into opposition to it. But he was dealing with a situation in which the Nazi regime was not coming down in one fell swoop and just taking out all opposition. They went after groups one by one. They targeted particular groups. They isolated them. They peeled them off. And then they put them away. And then they moved on to the next group. And Niemöller came into opposition to what was going on, but within certain bounds. You know, rather than standing up for others, Niemöller was trying to secure the safety of his own church, in this case, his own church. And what that meant was saving his own self or group, but not actually doing what was necessary. That was to come out in support and to take the necessary risks and to mobilize, you know, in the face of tremendous, tremendous repressive weight and might. But what would have happened, he said, if people did stand up for the communists when they came under attack? what a difference that would have made. Yes, tremendous sacrifice, and yes, people would have made supreme sacrifices because of the nature of that regime. But this was what was called for, and instead, the Nazi regime was able to peel people away, to purge its opponents one by one, and other forces, intellectuals, progressives, were not prepared to do what was called for, and that was to step forward to defend people. And it was no accident that they came for the communists first, because they were the most implacable opponents of the regime, and they stood for a different society and world, and for a way out of the oppressiveness of society and the world. And those are the people that were taken out first. And today, there's a comparable situation, that here you have, you know, the world and the state that it is. And actually, Michael, and to the listening audience, all of these repressive laws and all of what we're talking about, you know, in terms of Guantanamo, in terms of torture, all of these are reasons for us to recognize that this system is intolerable and it's bringing untold horror to the people of the world. And here, in this situation, if humanity is going to fight its way out of these horrors, well, then people are going to have to engage with and, you know, and respond to the work and the leadership of Baba Vinkin, because what he is doing is bringing forward a vision and a framework to get out of this horror and to create a world where people can truly flourish.
All right, Raymond, we're going to have to wrap it up there. We got about 20 seconds left.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
All right, and let me tell people that Raymond Lada recently gave a webcast on this, the National Defense Authorization Act. And if you want to get access to that webcast, go to revolutionbooksnyc.org. And there on the right-hand side, you'll find a bulletin board, and right there, you'll be able to click on that and access the webcast. And if you can't get that or you can't find it there, you can also go here, vimeo.com. That's V as in Victor, I, M as in mouse, EO.com. 5937764848. And having said that, that brings us to the end of yet another edition of the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer today, Henry Carson, and my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can and should at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, we're going to go out now with Communist Moon from International Noise Conspiracy.